Council, good morning to you. This is the case of Kaiser versus Kaiser. Mr. Vicanti, you are on WebEx, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
Very good. And Mr. Soul, you're here in the courtroom. Do either council have any questions before we begin?
No, sir.
Very good. Appreciate that very much. Mr. Vicanti, you then may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Christopher Vicanti, and I am the attorney for Matthew Kaiser, who was the defendant in the original dissolution action, but is the appellant in this case here. By way of background, the Kaisers, Mr. Kaiser and his former wife, Crystal, were divorced by a decree in Saunders County in December of 2018. The terms of that decree were stipulated to by the parties, and which included joint legal custody, joint physical custody, as well as an agreed upon child support amount and alimony. The petitioner in that case, Ms. Kaiser, filed a complaint to modify the terms of that decree some 7 months after the decree was entered. At that time, she was asking for custody of the children as well as an adjustment to child support. Mr. Kaiser then filed an answer and counterclaim in which he was also asking for custody of the children and an adjustment of child support as well as alimony. That was in June of 2019. The case eventually came to trial in July of 2020. The court was advised that the parties had reached an agreement as it related to custody of the children. And the agreement was that the parties would retain joint physical custody of their two sons, and that they would, Ms. Kaiser would have physical custody of the two daughters. And the children are, the oldest is a girl, the second is a boy, the next is a girl, the next is a boy. So they stair step down from there. So the real issues at the time of trial were to determine what the appropriate child support amount would be and whether alimony should be reduced, eliminated, or remain the same. The trial court entered its ruling and determined that there should be no change in child support, or no change in alimony, excuse me. And then came with a determination of child support, wherein Mr. Kaiser would be paying specific amounts for 4, 3, 2, and 1 children, respectively. As a result of that opinion from the trial court, Mr. Kaiser filed his appeal and basically had two assignments of error. The first was that Mr. Kaiser believed that he proved by sufficient evidence that his income had reduced and that the child support should be less than what the trial court determined. And second, and perhaps the more interesting of the issues, was Mr. Kaiser assigned as an error the manner in which the trial court calculated the child support in a unique situation like this, where we have joint physical custody of two children and sole physical custody of two others. And
counsel, I'd like to ask a question.
Sure.
How would you characterize what the trial court did in comparison to what exhibit number 76, which was your client's exhibit and proposal, asked it to do?
Yeah, and actually the trial court ironically adopted the proposal that we were making as far as child support. And while I'm not proud to say this, that was the calculation that we were proposing at the time. And what happened is, about that same time, we learned about the Perro case, which was an appellate case the Court of Appeals heard. And while I read that case, I didn't understand the methodology in which was used at that time. And I later learned what the methodology was, and that was a Sarpy County case with Judge Martinez. And then ultimately, the Court of Appeals determined that there was no abuse of discretion with the method that was used in that Perro case. So to answer your question, The court did adopt our suggestion, but I think this is a question of law. And I think this is one in which the trial court has a duty to receive the information, the income of the parties, what the appropriate deductions would be, and then come to its own independent determination as to what the child support should be. When we offer child support exhibits, we offer those basically as aids to the court and then rely on the trial court ultimately to make that determination. So
have we applied the invited error rule with respect to child support guideline calculations? And if we have not done so, has the Court of Appeals done so?
I am not aware of that, Your Honor.
Let's assume the Court of Appeals has done so. Why should we not apply the invited error doctrine when the trial court did exactly the methodology that you proposed?
I again believe that the court has a duty to make that calculation on its own. We are there as counsel for our clients, and as I mentioned earlier, we're proposing what we believe the child support should be. We weren't proposing a deviation to the guidelines. We were setting forth income with our suggestion. I again believe it's the duty of the trial court as well as appellate courts to look at the facts of the case and apply the appropriate methodology here, which...
So your argument is, as I understand it, that we should not apply the invited error doctrine.
That's correct.
Right? And the reason is because it's a question of law.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And have we not applied the invited error doctrine in the past to questions of law?
I don't know that answer, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Are you suggesting on a broader scale that we should do away with the invited error rule in all circumstances?
I don't think that is necessarily the appropriate way to do that. No, I'm not suggesting that. I do believe in this case that the method that the child support was calculated should be been done in a hybrid situation where we have joint physical custody of two children, we have sole physical custody of two children, and that we should have a methodology, because this is becoming more and more common in the state of Nebraska, we should have a methodology in which to calculate child support in that manner.
You would agree that the child support guidelines in and of themselves do not specify a single methodology for a hybrid case, right?
I would agree with that, yes.
Are you arguing that we should declare some methodology that might be perceived to apply to every hybrid case, or won't it depend on the facts of the particular case?
Well, I think it would depend on the facts of the particular case, but there are only so many options we can have with regard to custody of children. We can have sole custody, joint custody, or split custody. It's just when we have a hybrid situation like this, there isn't a methodology that is suggested to be used. And I think we're seeing this happen more and more. And that would be of good guidance to the practitioners as well as the court to have an appropriate methodology when we have this hybrid situation.
What was wrong with the methodology that you proposed to the district court?
Well, what we did was we proposed calculating the child support using two children with sole custody and two children with joint custody. When in retrospect, when we look at the actual child support amounts that should be ordered, we should have used four children and then taken half of that amount for both the sole custody calculation as well as the joint physical custody calculation. That would have resulted in a more fair result And the one that we, as I acknowledged earlier, we later learned was used in that Perro case, the appellate case.
The fact that an appellate court finds no abuse of discretion in one case doesn't mean this is the right way to do it from now forward, does it?
No, no, of course.
Discretion in doing it that way. Why does that translate into an abuse of discretion in the way the trial court did it here, particularly since it was the way the court was invited to do it?
Yeah, again, I understand that, and we would agree. We just think that this is a unique situation, an opportunity for the court to look at this situation and give the practitioners guidance as it relates to a hybrid custody calculation like this. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Soule. Good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed. Morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is John Soule and I represent the appellee. I won't repeat the facts. Mr. Vicani has accurately restated the factual basis, both in his oral argument and in his brief. Judge, I think what the appellant is wanting you to do is to come up with the specific mathematical equation for this unique situation. And this court has previously, and I believe as recently as Zapoleski, basically indicated to practitioners, the guideline is just that, a guideline. It isn't designed to meet every possible situation that exists. And as—
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller-Lerman. Opposing counsel has cast this for our attention as a question of law. Do you agree that this is a question of law?
No, I don't view it as a question of law, but as a question of fact. And the reason it's a question of fact is it will be a case by case scenario based upon the children, the parents' income, and the needs. If it was always a mathematical certainty, we wouldn't need judges. And of all things that family law is, it's an equity case. The court, the trial court, needs the flexibility to adjust. This court has looked at unique situations in the past, but usually it gives guidance to the practitioners when there is like an overall discrepancy in the computation or decisions. Best example I can think of is when Prochaska versus Prochaska first came out. You had some judges determining the child support based on remarriages one way and other judges doing it the exact opposite way. And this court then gave guidance, which gave us the Prochaska calculation. So whether the child was an afterborn child or a current child, neither benefited from the way that the calculation was done. And then in Zapoleski, the court specifically said, you know, we can't arrive at a mathematical certainty for each and every case.
Counsel, I want to turn your attention to the table underlying the child support guidelines and the theoretical underpinnings of the table. Isn't one of the principles of our child support guideline that's reflected in that table is that the cost, if you will, of each child that's added to a family is less than the child before it. In other words, the first child in the family costs the most, the second child less, the third child still less, the fourth child even more less.
And that's correct. And the marginal gap goes down and down with each dollar that that parent makes, or I shouldn't say that parent, or the parents make, until at some point in time, you can only feed a kid so much, clothe the kid in so high a fashion that the curve flattens at some point in time. And you would agree with that.
So the idea that your opponent advanced to the trial court that you'd calculate two children as if they were only two children, and another two children as if they were only two children, you actually are, if you add those together, you're going to be higher on the table for four children than you would for a four children calculation.
That would be correct.
Isn't that a flaw in the methodology that was proposed to the trial court?
It could be considered that, but by the same token, when you look at originally, you've got the parents sharing four children almost equally. Now, after the modification, you have one parent having the same custody arrangement for the boys as they had previously, but now having the girls full time. When you do that, as the court noted, when you have that first child, you have an increase in the support. Well, the two girls are there, let's say 100% of the time. That's not 100% correct, but from our argument and the hypothetical, let's say that. That means her burden for those two kids is just as if there were two separate children to start with at the highest level from dollar one and then flattening out as you get towards the top. And if you look at Crystal's income compared to his income, and this is a different argument, that her income, each dollar is significantly higher with less marginal income available for the extracurricular activities. The other thing that the court had to look at is, do we believe Matt, the appellant, that your income is as it was stated? One of the issues that was presented to the court was there a substantial change in circumstances in his income? He argued that his business income had deteriorated, and he showed his tax returns, et cetera, for the business. Now, the personal income is a different issue. The personal income actually, I believe, showed an increase due to a sale of certain marital assets. And what he was able to do with his income, he was able to build, I believe, an 1,800 square foot house, go on two or three vacations, give the children, the boys at least, fairly substantial Christmas gifts. And that's where it becomes a factual issue. Did the judge believe Matthew in saying that his business income, of which he was in control, had completely deteriorated? And of course, the second issue was, and as this court has reviewed, it's really not always based on your income. It's based on your earning capacity. Matt said, well, you know, when Crystal was gone, I just lost my spark. I didn't feel like working. Me neither. But I'm here today because most people, if they want to support their family, get to work. And that is precisely the court looked at that issue in a case called Sobotka versus Sobotka for the first time, comparing nationwide what you do when a guy really has a basis for a career change, but the needs of the children should have been put first. And even though it was uncomfortable physically for you to do this, and the doctor said it would, we're going to say, That's not a basis for a substantial change. So I think that was in the back of the court's mind as well, and saying, you just haven't proved a substantial change in circumstances that I'm going to change your income.
Of course, the in terms of the existence of a material change, the change in custody was itself a material change.
Oh, correct. Yes.
I beg your pardon. This is Justice Miller Lerman. Given the change in custody, what does that do to our analysis where we have something of the intersection of combined income, right, available from mom and dad, and as to your comment, economy of scale? All kids, all four kids in one household works differently than two and two, perhaps. So how does the change in custody impact our analysis / methodology at that intersection?
Well, now you're getting into the realm of mathematics, so I'm just going to
give you a broad, my opinion, and math was never my strong point, but I would say that that should benefit Crystal because she has four kids to feed, house, clothe, and make sure that they have sleeping arrangements. Mr. Kaiser has two and only two. So when you look at perhaps doing it mathematically, you've got a 75% to 25% arrangement. I think that's right, because you've got one having four kids roughly 50% of the time and two kids 100% of the time, which means that if I were to graph it, I would think that Crystal would have 75% of the expense load compared to Matt having 25%, where Matt's income is considerably higher than Crystal's income, if that makes any sense. Unless there's any additional questions, I have no further argument. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Thank you very much, Council. Thank you for appearing today, both in person and on WebEx.
Thank you.
And go on to the next case of the day, which is Signal 88 LLC versus Laconic LLC. Justice Miller Lerman is recused from this case and the other two cases of the day. The court will be joined by Judge George, Mr. Court Judge George Thompson.